I remember in 96, around Christmas time, I talked to Nick one morning in the office, and I just said, you know, Satan's coming at us every way he can. And the only thing that he hasn't attacked is our family. And so I'm praying desperately that God will protect our family. At that time, our oldest son was a senior in high school. Our middle son was in 10th grade, and our youngest was in 5th grade. And if you know any of our story, you know that on Easter Sunday morning of 97, our middle son died of an asthma attack. And I think that's where you really want to get out of the story, because you're not ready for what God's going to do with the story. We gathered at the hospital after Nick had gotten him there, and Nick so wisely said as we were driving home, we would not have chosen this. We would not have asked for this, but it's here, and we are going to honor God through it.
Hi guys, welcome back to Rural Mission. From time to time, I like to invite guests onto the show who aren't from Frontiers. There are so many wonderful mission agencies out there who share our passion for the lost, for Muslims and for gospel-deprived peoples. We want to learn from them too and hear some of their stories. I'm Matt, your host, and today I'll be talking with Ruth Ripkin, who spent many years with her family living in Malawi, South Africa, and Kenya. Now, she and her husband Nick are well known for the research they've done around the globe with the persecuted church, and for the books Nick has written called The Insanity of God, The Insanity of Obedience, and The Insanity of Sacrifice. But in this episode, Ruth shares her story of life in Africa, where they experienced much joy and fruitfulness, but also saw and suffered incredible hardships, including the loss of their 16-year-old son. Okay, well, it's a great joy for me to have a guest on the podcast this morning from Kentucky. Is that right, Ruth? Are you in Kentucky these days?
That's right.
Well, very big welcome to you, Ruth. For my listeners, Ruth Ripkin is a long-term worker overseas in many different countries, and we'll get into her story. But she's also well-known because she and her husband, Nick, have together done so much research into the persecuted church, and you guys have written books and so on as well, and probably a lot more that I don't know about. So yeah, it'll be great to hear all of the wisdom that you guys have acquired over the years through your experiences and through the experiences of others. Let's start, Ruth, with how did you first get a calling into global work, working overseas? Where did you start?
Well, it started around the breakfast table at my home. When I was a little girl, we had many, many missionaries that came into our home and we ate together. I heard their stories. My father was a pastor and missions was so much a part of our story. But at the breakfast table every morning, he would lay a map of the world out on that table. And my little brother and I would hear stories about these people we had met. And then my dad would have us guess what continent they were on, what country they were in. And so as a very young girl, I knew the world. I knew many of the names of countries and places. So it didn't take long for God to touch my heart. I was about 8 years old when I heard a lady from East Asia share her story at a camp for girls. And that's the night God said, that's what I want you to do. So from 8 years on, that's where I was headed.
That's wonderful. And I suppose in that case, your parents were always behind that idea, were they?
My parents were very supportive. When Nick and I knew that we wanted to be married, we went to my parents to say, this is what we want to do. Nick said, sir, I'd like to marry your daughter. He didn't look at him. He looked at me and he said, Ruth, what about your desire to serve God and be obedient to him? And I said, Dad, that's what we want to do. And Nick and I want to do it together. And we're headed that direction. And then my dad said, then I bless you. If you're going to be obedient to what God's asked you to do, I bless you in this journey. And he did. One of my deepest loves is parents who bless their children. And we remember so, so well my dad and my mom having us kneel before them as we got ready to go overseas. And each time that we would come home and go back, they would always bless us. There's a beautiful story of my dad when he got very old. My mom died and my dad lived by himself almost 15 years. And He called us when we lived in the Middle East and said, I need you to come home. And we thought, well, why? And he said, well, I just need you. And I said, my sister lives just a few miles from you, Dad. But he said, no, I need you. And we came back and we sat together, and my dad really was struggling with all kinds of health stuff. And I realized he needed me as the oldest daughter to be there. But Nick so wisely looked at him and said, but sir, we're not finished. God's not done with this part of our journey. And my dad looked at me very sad, but then he said, kneel. And we knelt before him, and he blessed us one more time to go back. And you know, man, I think that's something that I can jump in right now and say, if you don't have parents who are blessing you to be where you are, find someone who can be that for you, who can stand in the gap and say, I bless you. God's with you and I'm with you, and we're going to pray for you and support you. So, yeah, that led to a lot of my story, but it was so foundational in our journey.
Thank you. Gosh, wow, what a powerful place to start. I'm very touched by that. Yeah, I've had very supportive parents for all the years I was in Pakistan. But not everyone does. So thank you. That's a really encouraging word and good advice. That's so beautiful. Let's jump into when you met Nick then. I'm sure just because he was heading overseas wasn't the only thing you liked about him.
So what I loved about Nick was he was fun-loving. He loved the Lord. He didn't get embarrassed about his journey. He just shared that he had lived a very hard life. His family were construction workers and farmers. And, you know, that's just a hard place. And they were poor. So there were a lot of struggles. And he just kept pushing. He was the second one in his whole family to go to college. And when I met him, it was just, he was that adventuresome person that I needed, because I'm the person that I'm going to go one place and I'm going to spend my life there. And, you know, that's my thought. I was going to go overseas and live there, die there. I was not going to be moving around. Well, if you hear our story, you know, we moved over 38 times over those years.
Wow.
And God knew that I needed somebody who wasn't fearful about the unknown. He was just going to go. And I love his whole testimony is about reading Matthew 28 for the first time and reading those words, go. And he said, I knew I had to go. And so he just know how to do it. So we got to do it together.
That's awesome. And I wonder, you know, this was something you'd had as a little child in some ways from 8 years old onwards. Was it something he came to this mission calling in his teens or 20s later on in life?
He became a follower of Jesus at 18. And that's when he read the Bible for the very first time. His story is more like a Muslim story than somebody that's raised in America, in that he heard God say, go. No, he got to college. And when people said, do you want to be full time in the gospel? And he said, I didn't know I could be part time in the gospel. And so he just was, his naivety was so genuine. He was just going to obey God no matter what.
And you've been married how long?
48 years this year in July.
Praise God. That's great. So tell us then, where did you end up, first of all, in your many travels?
Well, we went to Malawi in East Africa with two children, a three-year-old and a five-year-old, two boys. And we began what I thought was my place. And we truly did love the people of Malawi. They are just very warm-hearted and gracious. And the only reason they don't follow Jesus is they've never heard. And so the joy of meeting people for the very first time and sharing Christ was just so exciting. We were seeing people baptized and churches started. People would sit on the side of the road thinking we might drive down that road that day. They were just ready. And the question they would ask us first was, we don't have God in our village, but we've heard you are the people that bring God to villages. Will you come to our village? So yes, you can live your whole life there and just love everything that's happening. But it wasn't long after being there that we began to get very sick. And We didn't have a clue what was going on, but we were getting malaria because the churches that we were working with were down along the coast, and that's where the malaria mosquitoes were living. We got very, very sick, and the doctor came to Nick and said, you know, if you don't get out of here in the next 2 weeks, you're going to see Jesus. And our leadership came, and this is another real, those markers in my life. One of our leaders who came to us to talk to us about this, he said, you know, Ruth, remember, serving God's not a matter of location. It's a matter of obedience. And that was very helpful, not at that moment, because in my heart, I was saying, I want to stay here, because even the week before all his Nick's worst experience with malaria, we planted a church. And, you know, I think that that's something God wanted to remind me later on in the journey, that he's responsible for the fruit. It's not me. Mm. He just needs me to be that pawn on the chessboard to get me where he needs me to be.
Were your kids pretty sick with malaria too at this time? And it, presumably this is, which decade are we talking when modern medicine wasn't even quite as effective as dealing with it?
All right. This was in the 80s. We arrived there in January 1st of 84, and they would give us quinine IVs to try to kill out the malaria, which is probably worse than the malaria because it makes your ears ring and you just don't feel good at all. Nick probably was the worst, but all four of us at one time were in a hospital room. We were all four in the same hospital room with quinine IVs, and the bathroom was down at the end of the hall. So you'd have to carry your little IV, whatever you call that, down the hall. And so with two little boys, that was quite a hilarious picture. During the time, it wasn't very hilarious.
Yeah. So did you have to then head back to the States for a while to recuperate? How long had you been in Malawi at that point?
We had been in Malawi 2 years, a little bit more than 2 years. And as they gave us options of what to do, they said, yes, you can go back to the States and we can look at where you want to go after that. Do you get better? And we began to think, you know, doctors in America have no clue about malaria. So let's just stay in Africa. And we chose to go to a black homeland in South Africa. So we had great medical care there. And it was probably a year before we really began to feel better and to begin to have some extra strength. But we fell in love with another people group at that time.
And I mean, was there something in the back of your mind that, oh, we might go back to Malawi? Or did you realize, no, that's the end of a chapter?
We were told that we probably would never be allowed to go back to Malawi. And just to give you a hint of what our journey has been, on our 25th wedding anniversary, 26, one of those anniversaries, we decided to go back and meet the people who had really mentored us and helped us through language school and everything in Malawi. And Nick got malaria again.
Oh, no.
And he, you know, there's just something about that mosquito in Malawi does not like us.
Yeah.
So, that was a wise decision for our leadership, just to say Malawi is out.
Okay, so what next?
All right, so we're in South Africa during apartheid, living in a black homeland. And your listeners may not know the story, but during the apartheid years, blacks could only live in these certain homelands, these certain places. Coloreds had a whole set of places they could live. Blacks had another. You had your Afrikaners and your English speakers. And so all these different people lived in their own areas. You did not cross over. We chose to work with the closest speaking people. They have three cliques in their language. We lived in one of their black homelands and studied language, moved out into a very, very rural part of this area. We lived about 30 miles from where Nelson Mandela was born. So you can imagine the area. At that time, there were two political parties, opposite tribes, ANC and the PAC, and they fought against each other, even though they were the same people. So it was a really learning time for me. I had never lived in racism like this at all. But we loved the churches. We loved what we were doing. And we loved the community we lived in. We were the only whites in this all-Black area. And our three, by that time we'd had a third child, three blonde-headed boys in that environment was very, very interesting. At first, they thought we were part of the South African white population. So they stoned our boys and did stuff like that, you know, with just rocks when they were riding in their bicycles. But it didn't take them long to realize this accent is not theirs. And so we just opened the door for people to be loved and learn culture. I think probably of any place we've ever lived, that's where we went deep into the culture, trying to understand and learn. I was homeschooling the boys and loved that because I'm a teacher at heart and my education is that. And we just fell in love with the people and fell in love with what we were doing. We were homeschooling, and we'd pack the books up and we'd go to the village and spend a week in all these little villages where churches were being planted. And we'd do school in the morning and then visit, and our boys would play and everyone would follow them because they just looked so strange to these little other children. And so it was a great time of our life.
I mean, I suppose so far then Malawi and South Africa is what many people think of as traditional missions, going to sub-Saharan Africa, living amongst the poor, blessing the church, maybe finding people who've never heard of Jesus and planting churches, amazing stuff. But it took a different turn. It wasn't where you ended up for life.
That's so true. We lived on a generator, and every afternoon we'd turn on the generator just to catch the news. And had no clue what God was getting ready to do with us. But we saw the situation in Sudan and the situation in Somalia on that news. We saw those little swollen bellies and just something that you picture is in somewhere, in some other world, not in ours. And God began to trouble our hearts and went to a meeting in Nairobi, Kenya. And while there, he talked to our leadership, and they were talking about needing somebody to go. For our group, our organization at that time, we really had no one in that part of Africa working with Muslims. So our leadership said, well, we'll keep in mind that you are thinking about this and praying about it. And Nick and I just really began to go back to the book of Acts. And as we read the book of Acts, it just became so clear that God was saying to us, South Africa has had workers for 200 years. Malawi has workers. What about those millions of people on the African continent who have no one? And that was all it took. And our leadership said, well, we'll talk about it and let you know. Well, they called, I think it was the last of July in 91. And they said, are you still serious about doing this? And we said, yes. They said, well, we need you here in 3 weeks. And so we rushed to pack, to sell, to, you know, trying to decide what do I take and what do I not take and all that. And then our youngest son, he got really, really sick the day we were to pack up. And he was in a hospital for a whole week, and they could not figure out what was going on, but the fever went down. And so we got on a plane and we flew to Kenya and started language school the next morning. The mission that we were going to be part of required us to learn Swahili first before we could even look at going to Somalia, which there's no rhyme or reason for it. You just say, yes, sir. And so we did. We studied Swahili. God used that in our lives to help us learn the culture of Kenya, because we realized we can't take three little boys into a war zone, which was what was happening in Somalia. And so it was a good foundation to lay as we prepared to go.
So how many years was it in South Africa before the move to Kenya?
We were 7 years in South Africa.
Okay. Was it quite heart-wrenching to leave that behind?
Yes, it really was. I'm a crier, so I can cry at the drop of a hat. But there are days when I really, really grieve and cry. And, You know, I think I still grieve because we did leave so fast. We didn't get to say farewell to so many of the people that had invested in us and loved us and cared for us. And that's probably one of my regrets, is that with each of these moves, we haven't kept up as best as we could with people that we leave behind.
Yeah, it's very hard, isn't it, when you've built these relationships, but you can't sustain the levels of friendship that you'd like to, can you?
That's exactly right. But the leadership of that area and the other workers that we left behind, they kept us up on what was happening and that kind of stuff. So I do feel like we know a lot that happened. But South Africa was a fun place to be. And if you've never been there, you need to. They are some of the most hospitable people.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful country too. Do you have any tips? I mean, you've moved so many times in life. You've begun to see things established. You've started seeing fruit. You probably think, yes, we could stay here. This is good. This is God's kingdom work. And yet, here we go again. We've got to leave it all behind. It just can be so frustrating. Whether you've chosen it or not chosen it, I'm sure there have been times that we'll come to in your story when you did not choose to move on. But any tips for those out there going through transition that just did not want that kind of change and moving countries again?
I think God, as He's preparing me to move, He always has given me a heart that said, it's not yours, it's mine. And God reminds me that I'm on this journey with Him, and He just wants me to stay in that story that He's writing for me. After leaving Malawi and having malaria, after starting another language, all those times I could have said, I throw up my hands, I quit. But there was an oughtness in my heart. And having Nick along with me, he's willing to lay down what needed. And for us to go to Somalia, there were a lot of things we had to lay down. We had to lay down our abilities and our thinking that, you know, if we had enough people praying for us, if we had enough money, if we had the right people on our team, we could solve anything. And when we got to Somalia, the border, we realized I could have all the world praying for me and things could still be horrible. And so I think the big thing is just stay in God's story. Don't let a transition, being kicked out of a country, saying the wrong thing and paying for it, all of those things that come up when we are living in tough places where Satan is in control, don't give Satan a chance to let fear come in or let your attitude come in or just realize it's too hard. It's always too hard. And I think that's the thing. We're in a battle that's beyond us.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. So tell us about Somalia in the time when you arrived, when you first made those trips. So presumably you're going back and forth from Kenya doing trips. What was the vision and what did it look like? What did it feel like? What was happening in that country for those who know nothing about that part of the world?
We did a lot of talking and groveling to people who had experienced this kind of thing. In your organization, many of your people stepped up to help us. And so I have to say, it was a team of people who were reaching that. The devastation of Somalia, and we traveled in and out. There's a verse where the children of Israel are in Egypt, and it's when the plagues are happening. And it talks about that there was darkness that could be tasted. When I flew into Somalia for the first time, that's exactly what it felt like. It was darkness that could be tasted. You could feel the oppression and the depth of despair. Watching a man, and he probably wasn't that old, but he looked to be 90 years old, and he was probably maybe 30, lying on a bed, just totally starved. And the flies were all over his body. I had to scream, you know, what in the world is this? And to realize that people had done this to themselves, that the hatred by clans, that racism that I learned about in South Africa now became real for me. You know, the devastation of the famine was there, but it was as a result of human evil. And, you know, people do things to each other that animals don't do. But watching starving babies, burying babies that had died in the night. And there was food in the market. There was food, but people couldn't afford it. And so they were starving. Oh. And the Western countries sent in supplies and aid and all that. But it was just horse corn that we didn't want to use in our countries, and we'd send it there. We had good team members. We had horrible situations where team members clashed and had to work on that. But God was saying, I need you here right now. And we knew that. And Nick usually went in 4 to 6 weeks at a time. And I learned to drive in Nairobi and get across Nairobi and deal with traffic and get our boys to school and haul water because we didn't have water in our water tank. And it was just that sweet, sweet time where the Lord was so very close to us. And I'll go on and just share this as I think about it. We were seeing that there was just violence coming at us in many different ways. Believers were being killed. Out of 10 million Somalis in Somalia, there were only about 150 followers of Jesus that we knew of. And they were hunted down. There was not a gathered church there. It was just individuals and maybe a few that gathered together. We saw that when the men became followers of Jesus, that the women were not given those long years to understand and believe on their own. Their husbands declared faith for their wives. And so when these believers were martyred, the wives went back to the mosque, went back to the leadership of the mosque and turned in the names of all the believers that they had met through their husbands. And so the huge persecution of believers in Somalia was a result of women not being given the entire gospel and not being mentored into faith. Rather, they just were told, this is a Christian home. I'm a man. I live here. I'm the Christian. That makes you a Christian. And so we were dealing with that kind of stuff. And then we were dealing with some team issues. And all of us know that when team issues happen, it just eats at you. We were dealing with knowing that it looked like the troops were going to pull out and therefore there wouldn't be as much security. We would need to go to another location in country. And we were having to move in Nairobi and lots going on. And I remember in 96, around Christmas time, I talked to Nick one morning in the office and I just said, you know, Satan's coming at us every way he can. And the only thing that he hasn't attacked is our family. And so I'm praying desperately that God will protect our family. At that time, our oldest son was a senior in high school. Our middle son was in 10th grade and our youngest was in 5th grade. And if you know any of our story, you know that on Easter Sunday morning of 97, our middle son died of an asthma attack. And I think that's where you really want to get out of the story because you're not ready for what God's going to do with the story. We gathered at the hospital after Nick had gotten him there, and Nick so wisely said as we were driving home, we would not have chosen this. We would not have asked for this, but it's here, and we are going to honor God through it. Matt, we had people from every faith system in Nairobi. We had hundreds of workers from all organizations who flooded our home during those days. We had people bring food. In fact, we did not fix one meal during that time from March until we came back to the state after our son graduated from high school. And we didn't fix a meal. People came. Our chief of staff from Somalia, from Mogadishu, walked 5 days from Mogadishu to Nairobi to be with us. And he was not a follower of Jesus at that time. As we stand before churches now, we say, you know, if a Muslim would do that for a Christian, what do we owe Muslims as we share Christ with them, as we live our faith next door to them? We buried our son at the school where he went. because in his mind, he was always going to come to the States, get his degree, and go back and teach at that school. But as we said, we would not have chosen that, but God used it to remind us what it is for the body of Christ to be the body of Christ. And even though a lot of these people were not followers of Jesus, at our son's funeral, about 30 young people gave their lives to Christ as a result, because our son had lived his faith out in front of all these people. There were people who came to our house and said, "Your son sat with my daughter at the mall the other day, and just, she was lonely, she's depressed, and he sat with her and just talked to her and was so kind. She came home so happy." And so there were people that we didn't even know our son was relating to. And, you know, if a person is dealing with grief in a couple, they usually grieve differently. Mm-hmm. And the big thing, we had to give grace to each other. Nick and I grieved so different. But as we gave grace to each other, God used that, because we've had so many friends who have lost children, who after the child has died and they've buried and they've tried to live, they just can't deal with it anymore and they divorce. I have to say, our marriage is stronger because we walk through those days together. Our marriage is stronger because God took us right back to the roots of your church family and how vital it is. We had people praying for us. We struggled a lot with those days. But when we came back to the States, we moved back on the college campus where we had met. The college provided us a house, and we were ministered to by college students. College students put us back together. They checked on us. They loved us. They wanted to hear our story and God's story. We began a missions fellowship at the school. And in that, we began to share our story. And that's when God began working on our hearts to jump back in.
Thank you for sharing that. It's just such a tough part of your story to go back to again and again, I'm sure. But were there times where you really did cry out in desperation to God, saying, "Why, Lord, we've given up so much for you. You know, does it have to be us to go through this?" You know, plenty of Psalms where there's just that cry of the heart, isn't there? "Why, Lord, the rest of the world seems to be doing so well and the righteous are suffering." And I suppose you had those moments.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. From a little girl, I always did my devotions in the morning. And so that was a habit of mine. So every morning I'd get up and I'd go sit in the chair that I'd sat in every morning. I'd open my Bible. And like you said, it was the Psalms that I went to. And usually I could get through the first verse of a Psalm. And then I would just stop and cry. And usually I would just start saying help, because I didn't know what else to pray. And I just cried help. And that went on probably for about a year before I could really sit and do more than just read a little bit of the Psalms and move on to talking and praying.
Sharing this podcast is a really good way to encourage more people to get involved with God's great mission, whether locally or globally. So please do help us get the word out there. If you use an iPhone, it's pretty easy to write us a review, and that has a big impact on how many people can find us. Alternatively, you could share one of your favorite episodes with a few of your friends. Thanks, guys. And now let's get back to the podcast.
I think another really key thing that helped me was, as a little girl, my mom had pounded in me to learn scripture verses. I stood beside the refrigerator while she would wash dishes, and she'd say, "All right," and she'd give me the reference, and I'd say the verse. And standing in that hospital, the verse that came to my mind was one of those verses I'd learned at the refrigerator by my mom. "Thou art my rock and my strength, my ever-present help in trouble." And that verse just echoed in my mind over and over. And as I was trying to understand what was going on, I think the thing that kept coming to my mind is, you know, Jesus got on that cross. He obeyed you. And he did what you asked him to do. And if you hurt as bad as I'm hurting, how could you stand to leave him on that cross? And I think that was a good way that God used in my heart to say, I know what you're going through. I know how you're feeling, and I'm not going to leave you. And he didn't. He hasn't. And like I said before, looking back, I see all the ways that God carried us. And our next part of our story is when God took us to believers in persecution. And each time we met someone to hear their story, we started with our story and shared about our son's death. And that opened the door for them to share their story, because they understood that we understood them. We had no clue what we were doing. Once again, Somalia, we had no clue. Now we had no clue. But we knew that urgency, we needed to get to believers in persecution to find those things that would help us as we go, as Westerners or people from other cultures to a new culture. What do we do to partner wisely with believers who are living every day when it costs so much? We didn't know in Somalia. We had gone and asked a lot of people for help, but we realized the help had to come from somebody who was living it, those people who were in the midst of persecution. And so we would go, we would tell them why we were there. We'd share a little of our story, and we'd say, we've come to learn. We want to be learners. We come with open hands asking you to teach us. And when we started that way, rather than asking 16 questions, we got their whole story. And we found out, when was the first time you heard about Jesus? When was the first time you got a Bible? What did your neighbor say? What do your parents say? All those things that are so key if we're going to make a difference and partner wisely with them.
So the whole idea of this new stage in your ministry was to learn from the persecuted brothers and sisters around the world. Was there any particular focus on Muslims, or at this stage, was it, we're going to just research this all over the world to help folks going cross-culturally to understand the consequences, the cost, the challenges of local believers?
Yeah. We had we called it our persecution task force, and we divided up the world, realizing that part of the world has had persecution a reality from government for many years, and they were easier maybe to get to. So that's why we started in the former Soviet Union, all of the stands, those areas. Then we went to China. A lot of these trips, Nick had to go by himself because our youngest was still at home, but he recorded each story and then I typed it up. So I heard the story just as much as if I was sitting in the room. So we did China on that trip, and then we did Indonesia with China. So there we hit the Muslim world. We also then went into the Buddhist world some, and then into Hinduism. And the last stage, we did the Muslim world because we knew we needed to know what all these other areas had taught us before we got there, because we saw some real things lacking in how the Muslims were coming to faith and what they were dealing with in persecution. And we wanted to be geared up before we got there. So we did about 650, 700 interviews in about 72 countries. And people kept saying, well, you can do a lot of these interviews in America, but we wanted to go to where they were actually there, where they had stayed the course, where they were in the midst of the persecution, where it was fresh on their minds. And so we learned so much. And there were just a lot of divine encounters, because we would get to a country thinking we had contacted someone who was going to set up interviews, and got there and they weren't sure they could trust us, so they hadn't done anything. And so you get there and you end up doing interviews right till you get to the airplane, because they got to learn from you first, and then they'll start introducing you to people that would share their stories. And we haven't found anywhere where someone got hurt because we went. We tried to be as wise and take our leads and our cues from them.
And so the whole purpose of this, was it to write the book, or was the book a sort of oh, we've got all this stuff, let's turn this into a book?
We had no interest in writing a book ever. The whole thing was we were going to do everything by going to mission groups, to schools, to churches, to share what we had learned and do it all orally.
Mm-hmm.
But then we got to the end, you know, where a lot of those people were safe now, or they weren't in areas where they were persecuted. Their witness had been carried out and people knew they were believers and they had accepted it, that kind of thing. So we knew we could write. We used pseudonyms for everyone. Often we didn't even use locations and that kind of thing. Our desire was to write this, what became the second book, first, because it was the, it's the lessons that we've learned from these believers, Insanity of Obedience. It's the blood, sweat, and tears that people go through to make Christ known in places of persecution where many of your listeners live. That was the only book we wanted to write. And we did it on our computer for a while, and we found that it raised up so much interest, and so many people were asking so many more questions of what we had learned, that we met with a man who became our book agent. Yeah, whoever thought of a book agent, but he looked at that he listened to our story one day in a meeting, and he just said, "You're cheating the church. The church needs this. It's not that just people on the field need it. The church needs to know better how to pray for believers and how to pray for workers. So they need it as desperately as everybody else." And then he said, "But you have to write your story first, because people will buy your story and then they'll begin to want the other book." So that's kind of the order that it happened.
So how did you land on this title, The Insanity of God and The Insanity of Obedience?
Well, we struggled with the title for a long time. And finally, we decided to get some people who love us and care for us, and our book agent and several writers came, and we sat around the living room and everybody threw out titles and we threw out verses. We had met almost a whole day, and Nick went out of the room for a while and he came back in and he looked at all the titles that we had put on the whiteboards and the paper. And he said, "You all realize this represents the insanity of God according to what man thinks. Why would God call people to himself and then have them be persecuted?" He said, "It makes no sense. Why would God send his son to die on a cross? No God ever in history does that." And our agent looked at him and slammed his hand on the table and he said, "That's it. It's the insanity of God." And Paul talks about the foolishness of God, and it truly is. In our mindset, in the mindset of people that we go to love and serve and live among, the story we're telling, it's insane. It's not believable. Yet it's the grace of God and the love of God that we want to tell them about.
Oh, that's great. Ruth, give us a couple of snippets of some of those interviews that you did, any that stick in your memory, either because of what they went through or because of what they taught you.
There's a young lady in a Central Asian country that we met. The UN evacuated her soon after he met her because she was being targeted because of what she was doing. It had nothing to do with Nick being there or anything, but she had led 36 Muslim women to faith. I can't tell a lot more about what was happening to her, but the UN decided she needed to get to America, which was probably the worst thing that we could have done because she was being so bold. And we find often that when they come to America, their faith does not grow like it was growing in the places where they live. But she came to the States. I had her come and visit us. It was during those months that we were at the college. She transformed that college campus. I mean, those college students ate up everything she said and had her go to class with them, and just a dynamic lady. But she went to church with us for the first time that she'd ever been to a Western church. And on that Sunday, there was a baptism, which was very unique at that time, but it was a whole family. And she sat between Nick and I, and he was watching this, and she got real fidgety, and Nick thought she was having a panic attack because she'd never been in a place where men and women and everybody were sitting together. And she just leaned over and she just said, "Are you telling me a whole family in this country can be baptized and nobody's going to go to jail? Nobody's going to be persecuted?" She was just in awe of that event happening. And Nick said, "Yeah, that's right." She says, "Well, I think I'm going to stand up and shout." And Nick said, "Well, stand up and shout. And if they kick you out, we'll go with you." She's still in America, still trying to figure out what faith just looks so different here than it did for her in her home country. The story probably that most readers remember from the book is the story of Dimitri, who was sent to prison for 17 years. And he would stand beside his bed every day in a prison with 1,500 prisoners, none of them believers. He was the only one. And he would sing his heart song every morning that he had learned as a little boy. He would sing that every morning. He'd raise his hands and the prisoners would laugh at him. And it's just a long story, but he was finally released because they couldn't figure out what to do with him. But when they started to take him to the execution yard, the prisoners stood up and sang that song they'd heard him sing every morning, and the guards were totally overwhelmed by that. But we heard that he had died not too long ago. This is chapter 2 of the book that people, if they've read Dimitri, they'll want to know this. We heard that he had died, and Nick texted a religious website that was in that country where he could find where he was. And the son called him and said, "No, Dad's not dead. He's still alive. In fact, he's sitting right here." And we could hear him talking in the side. And he said, "Dad's so excited every morning. He gets up and he said, the men of the prison told me that my story would end there, that it would never be heard. And now my story's all over the world." And he was just so excited. He's about 80-something now.
Wow. So why was he not executed on that day after all the other prisoners
were
singing?
Because the guards were so overwhelmed with what they had seen the prison do. They let him go.
Wow.
So, yeah, just neat stories. But the son, at the end of the call, after he said, "No, Dad is still alive. He hurts a lot from all the beatings and stuff." But he said, "But I have to tell you one more thing before you hang up." He said, "I'm now the chaplain of the prison that held my dad for 17 years.
Wow.
It gives me goosebumps every time I think about it. And that's what, you know, living through the persecution and getting to the other side, we do see victory. And so that's one of the big things we teach in churches is what can we learn from believers in persecution that will lead to that DNA of the resurrection?
Yeah, tell us more about that, because there must be stories where they don't end up so joyfully. You know, believers sometimes are persecuted and it ends in death. Sometimes the church is snuffed out. It's not always that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, at least in our small window of understanding. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. And we always remind people that the blood of the martyr is the seed of the church, where the church is strong and where the believers are strong. And there's a great number of them. But for many of us, we work in that pre-Pentecost era where the believers are scattered, they're alone, they're afraid, they don't even trust one another. And I think that's where we can really, really pray that God will gather the believers together, because it's biblical. We will not grow strong if we're out there and we're the only one. And yes, you're right. And I don't ever want to let people believe that everything's going to be rosy and beautiful. And we've got too many of our friends who have been martyred for their faith. But we have to remember that this is a long journey and eternity is forever. And the picture that I have of what a martyr is, you know, martyr's life being snuffed out, will not be the picture that I'll have through eternity. And I've sat with too many women, especially workers, who've dealt with just the loss of a spouse on the field, loss of children, loss of jobs, and you know, loss of friendships. You know, women especially now are being put in prison. There for a time, the women in prisons around the world for being followers of Jesus was very small. But now we're hearing more and more of women who are bold. I'm thinking of a sister in a country that I love very much that's been in prison now since late last year. She had her baby while she was in prison, and she stayed faithful. I have another friend, she denied her faith, and now she's dealing with all of that guilt that comes from denying her faith. Mm. I have a friend in a Middle Eastern country who never would say yes to Jesus because she says, I just can't do it. I love Jesus, I believe in him, but I just can't make it public. And so yeah, there are those things that I guess God will make them clear one day.
Yeah, and you're right to draw our attention to the end of the story, you know, which is so far beyond this world, because otherwise so much of what we do doesn't make sense. You know, as Paul said, if it weren't for the resurrection, we're the most stupid of all people and to be pitied above all people. But with eternity in mind, then it's worth it, isn't it? And I suppose, you know, that's where we get to, isn't it? Why is this worth it? Is he worth it? Well, if eternity's real and if Christ was raised from the dead, then yes.
And I think one thing we have to keep in mind is there is no resurrection if there wasn't a crucifixion.
Mm.
And so in our lives, that crucifixion may not look the same, but it's there and the resurrection's coming.
Yes. And we want the power of the resurrection, but in the same verse, it says the fellowship of his sufferings. And so we've got to be ready for that as well. To take both. Ruth, before we finish, just one thing that has been on my mind to ask you. You yourself have, in some ways, had seasons of your life where Nick has been off and about, traveling, doing all the interesting stuff around the world, doing all these interviews. And whether you were stuck with young kids at some point, you know, in Kenya while he's in and out of Somalia, and you've had weeks and weeks at a time with him not there, how have you dealt with that kind of loneliness, perhaps, or frustration at times? And how do you counsel women, like you say, that you've sat with, chatted with, whose husbands are off in jail and everyone's praying for the husbands, but they might be feeling very forgotten and very abandoned and not so supported as the husbands who are facing the immediate and obvious persecution?
Yeah, and I think there's just so many things running through my mind right now. One of the things that I learned to do was as I dropped him at the airport or I sent him to the airport, I would take time to just pray right there and stop long enough to say, all right, Lord, I don't know what these days are going to hold. I don't know if he'll ever come back, but will you prepare my heart, prepare me for what will come? And that was kind of that encouraging time where I realized I couldn't do it on my own, and so I needed God's help. So I did that. I always kept in mind what I would do first if I found out he wasn't coming home, who I would call. That would be my first thing. So I think that's something. The other thing I learned to do was with the children, when they were at home, we would plan what we would do when Dad left. And the first thing we did on the night before he left, we had a meal together. And we would, you know, pray for Dad as he left. And then the whole time he was gone, we planned a party. We were planning a party for when Dad got back. And that kept everybody excited. And the plans would change. And each child would figure out what their role was going to be in the party. And so that kept us busy. And I think if I had sat around and just been moaning about him being gone all the time, it would have been miserable. But there were a lot of things to be involved in. And to get out my front door and to go and to do was what I had to do. Making sure my quiet time, I kept it up. That was a vital part of my life. And being engaged in what was happening where I was, because I knew Nick was engaged where he was. And I have to mention that during these years, until we started doing the interviews, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have email. It was long before all of that was happening. And so we often wonder, how would our lives have been different if we'd had cell phones? But who knows? It might have been worse because we would have known what each other was doing.
Yes, that's true. And of course, maybe he'd have had to, in many of these countries, go silent and turn off phones and not have them with him anyway. So there still are times, aren't there, where, yeah, we can't be in constant contact. And one more thing then, just before we wrap up. Many of our listeners, they're not on the field. They've never done this, anything like this in their lives. They live a comfortable life in a Western situation, perhaps, or maybe in a nice city in Korea or Malaysia or somewhere like that. And they believe in God's mission, but they've never really thought, I could do that, because they might have fears, they might have anxieties. What do you do these days in terms of encouraging folks to consider God's global heart, to consider the ends of the earth, the most unreached places, even the most dangerous places? What on earth can we say to folks that might not completely put them off, but encourage them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we don't want to scare them off. But, you know, I think the thing that I challenge people with is, when you go see God at work in other cultures, other places, these dangerous places, even a place where it's not so dangerous, when you go, God becomes more real, and your studying of the Word, your Bible, your church experience, your worship experience, it all changes. So why would you want to miss that? And I'm one of those, as I said in the beginning, I go one place, I'm happy, I'll stay there. But I am so grateful God has allowed me to experience the world and experience other people. And I think the thing that we have to remember is, the world is next door to you. It's not all the way around the world. It's not thousands of miles. It's next door. If you've never met your neighbor or the person across the street, you might find that their story is so much more like the stories I've been telling. And so if you'll do it here or wherever you're living, you'll do it anywhere. So go meet your neighbor, and they're waiting on you. So find out what their story is. See where your story and God's story intersects, and you'll be able to figure out that God's got great things in store for you, even next door to you.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a great word. I remember my wife, when she was single, and she's from California, she did a little internship in Arizona because she had a heart for Muslims and for going where the gospel is most needed. But she thought, do I have anything in common with Muslim ladies? So she did this internship. She got to know Somali ladies, and she got to know Afghan ladies. And she realized, yeah, people are people, whatever culture they're from. And these guys, yeah, I can connect with them, and I can share with them about God's love. And it's not as hard as we might think. But I still think sometimes people think, well, I don't know if I'm qualified for this, or I'm spiritual enough, or maybe I don't have a quiet time every morning. So maybe I couldn't really do what Ruth and Nick have done over many, many years. Any encouragements for those who are just feeling, I'm too weak for this, or too ordinary for this?
I'm too weak. I'm totally too weak. And I was talking to someone last night, and they were saying, oh, but you can do that. And I said, no, I didn't do any of this. It was God. And God was the one who carried me and did this. And I was just living my life and trying to be obedient. And like I said before, it's not about location. It's about obedience. Are you being obedient to what God needs you to do right now? And if you're leaning on that crutch to say, I'm too weak, remember what he did with Moses. He may send you all over the world. Just because Moses said, I can't talk. And God said, well, I'm going to show you. You can talk. And he gave him Aaron, and Aaron talked for him. But then if you look at the story, Moses talked just as much as Aaron did. And so I think what I would say is, don't live in your fear, and don't live in the fact that you're making excuses, because God wouldn't ask you to do it if he wasn't going to do it with you. And I love it. I love getting to do it. So I challenge you, lay down those fears, because that's Satan's tool.
Thank you. That's good. And always to remind ourselves, I suppose, too, that God loves to use the weak to shame the strong. This is what we were talking about with the foolishness of the gospel and the insanity of God. But this is part of it. Yeah. He chooses the ordinary to do the extraordinary because it's his power, and it always is his power and his strength. So it's better, actually. He's looking for people who'll say yes, not who are strong people, because that's how he loves to operate. Brilliant. Well, I don't want to, but I'm going to draw it to a close, Ruth. I really am so grateful for your time. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks for sharing your story, and especially the vulnerable and tough things. I know that's a cost to you. But yeah, we bless you, and we pray the Lord will continue to use you in many, many ways with the church around the world, with the church in your home country and town and so on, with students. And we're praying for a new generation of young yeah. and old folks willing to go to the ends of the earth, because there's still a big job to be done, isn't there, out there, let alone in post-Christian Europe and America. But we're talking about places, a third of the world that's never had the gospel, or at least has no access to the gospel these days. So yeah, bless you in all that you're doing. And thank you so much again for being with us.
Blessings to you and each of your listeners.
Great. Thanks, Ruth. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for joining us today, guys. For more, check out our website, frontiers.org.uk, our social media platforms at frontiers.uk, or you can email me personally, matt@frontiers.org.uk. Here's a great quote to end with from the Chinese preacher and martyr Watchman Nee. To keep our hand on the plow while wiping away our tears, that is Christianity. Have a great weekend. Hope to see you next time.